Today is the last Sunday before Lent begins, which means today is Transfiguration Sunday. And I have a confession to make. I love the stories of the Bible, like really love them. If I'm ever teaching and you're with me, you'll hear me say that a story is one of my favorites. I never really disclose how vast my pool of favorite stories is. But my confession this morning is that the story of the Transfiguration is not in that pool. In fact, I've only ever preached on this two other times before. I went looking for that this week, so I've found other excuses to skip this Sunday over the years. Maybe that needs to be explored, but at any rate, this story is strange and complex and really hard to explain. Now, part of the reason it's hard to explain, of course, is because it defies explanation. Mystery and miracle are afoot up on that mountain. We shouldn't expect to understand it. But the other reason it's hard to explain is because this scene on the mountain is packed with allusions and symbolism that require a robust understanding of the biblical story, and I don't know how to walk us through all of that in 15 minutes. But that doesn't mean I won't try. Please pray with me. May the words of my mouth and the meditation of all of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O God. Amen. Today, I'd like for us to think about this story as if it were a television show doing a flashback episode. So take a moment, think of your favorite show that's done that, where they take you back and show you either things you've seen already in previous episodes or maybe disclose to you things you've never actually seen before. Our episode today starts in the present day when Jesus takes Peter, John, and James up on a mountain to pray. Suddenly, Jesus is transfigured before them. His face changes and his clothes become as bright as lightning. Elijah and Moses appear, and I imagine that the camera slowly zooms in on the disciples' reactions. Their faces register an idea, and the show flashes back to the thoughts the disciples are processing. Our first stop is our Old Testament reading for this morning. We see Moses, face aglow at the foot of Mount Sinai, holding the replacement tablets containing the laws that would govern life in the Promised Land. You may recall that he smashed the first ones in anger over the golden calf incident. Moses often had meetings with God, and when he would return, his face would shine. So Moses donned a veil. Notably, not to protect himself from God, he took the veil off during those meetings. No, the veil somehow protected the Israelites from the holiness reflected in Moses' face. Moses' face shone the way that Jesus' does at the Transfiguration. And we join the disciples in wondering what this connection with Moses reveals to us about Jesus. Suddenly, we cut to another mountain, Mount Horeb, where a discouraged Elijah asks God to take his life. God doesn't do that. Instead, God gives him a nap and a snack. And then God appears to Elijah not in the wind, not in the earthquake, not in the fire, but in the sound of sheer silence. The prophet Malachi foretold that Elijah would return before the coming day of the Lord. And we join the disciples wondering what it means that this one who would return in the last days, that Elijah, is here now with Jesus on the mountaintop. Our show returns to the present, back to the eyes of disciples trying to sort out what they see before them. But their bewilderment grows as they overhear Jesus, Moses, and Elijah discussing not the past, but what is yet to come. Luke records it this way: they appeared in glory and were speaking about his, Jesus's, exodus, which he was about to fulfill in Jerusalem. Another exodus? What does that mean? Again, I imagine we follow the disciples' thoughts as the show flashes back to Moses on the shore of the Red Sea, his staff raised and the waters parted behind him, leading his people out of Egypt during the first Exodus. And the director splices together snippets of key events: the wandering in the wilderness, the battle against the Canaanites, Israel finally settling into the promised land. All of that is going to happen again? Soon we're back in the present. Moses and Elijah make to leave the mountaintop, and Peter scrambles to his feet to stop them. He's desperate to preserve this moment while they try to sort out its meaning. He doesn't know what he's saying and blurts out, "Master, it is good for us to be here. Let us set up 3 tents, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." It might just seem that Peter's a rambling fool here, but there's a reason tents are on his mind. Again, we cut to the days of the first Exodus, and we see that tent with a pillar of cloud at the entrance, the tent of meeting. Moses is in the tent of meeting, conversing with God face to face as he did in those days. Now, this tent certainly did not contain God, but it offered visible and tangible signs of God's presence among God's people. Israel was not out there in the wilderness all alone. God was present with them. Back in the present, the disciples will build no tents, but God's presence does arrive once more in the form of a cloud. And the cloud envelops them, and predictably, the disciples are terrified. God speaks, "This is my son, my chosen. Listen to him." Again, a memory is triggered for the disciples, and we flash to another time and place, this time much more recently. On the banks of the Jordan, John the Baptist raises Jesus back out of the water, and a voice from heaven speaks similar words. "You are my son, the beloved. With you I am well pleased." And now we flash to just a mere verses before this scene on the mountaintop, when Jesus asks the disciples, "But who do you say that I am?" And Peter boldly proclaims, "The Messiah of God." Peter is correct, of course, but Jesus follows up this confession by clarifying that this means, as Messiah, he will suffer, be rejected, and die. And for those who want to follow him, they must also take up their crosses and follow in his ways. Might these be the same kinds of things that Jesus, Moses, and Elijah are discussing on the mountain? We settle back to the present. The cloud is gone. Moses and Elijah are gone. Jesus is no longer shiny. Back to normal. It's all over. And the disciples' minds race with the stories of their ancestors and their own memories of their days with Jesus. And they wonder what we wonder: what does it all mean? The Transfiguration is this rich moment where the presence of heroes of Israel's past legitimize the work Jesus is doing. They confirm for the disciples that the God of all those stories they grew up with is moving again in and through Jesus. And the scene is punctuated by God's own voice. What was declared to Jesus at his baptism, "You are my son." And what Peter confessed about who Jesus is, "The Messiah of God." God affirms with, "This is my son, my chosen. Listen to him." In this incredible company, Moses and Elijah, our great patriarchs of Israel, God tells the disciples to listen to Jesus. Over Moses and Elijah, even. But the richness of this scene is not reserved just for how it connects to Israel's history. In addition to pointing backward, the scene always also points forward, foreshadowing events that will unfold as Luke finishes telling the story he set out to tell in the gospel. The transfiguration anticipates the resurrection appearances. Jesus' glory is revealed on this mountain in a temporary and limited way. But on the other side of this long road he must now travel to Jerusalem, his glory will be fully and permanently revealed. This revelation will not be found in public rubbing elbows with important people or in taking a place on a throne in a palace with a scepter in hand. No, paradoxically, we will see Christ's glory fully displayed on a cross. And so now, our television show flashes forward to the cross and Jesus' final words, "Father, into your hands I commend my spirit," and to the Roman centurion who, as witness, declares, "Certainly this man was innocent," and to the tomb where the stone is secured at the entrance, and then to Easter morning where the tomb is empty and witnesses wear similarly dazzling clothes, to the ascension where Jesus takes his place at the right hand of the Father. These are scenes of a future the disciples do not yet know. And so our episode ends back in the present with the stunned disciples beginning to make their way back down the mountain. We know more than they do. We know what they have seen as a mere preview of the glory that will be revealed when Jesus fulfills what he discussed with Moses and Elijah, his exodus in Jerusalem. Luke reports that Peter, John, and James tell no one what they saw on the mountain, which seems incomprehensible. But maybe they are like Mary, pondering these things in their hearts and waiting to see how it all plays out. What does it mean that Jesus is leading another exodus? What exactly is Jesus rescuing people from? Where will he lead them? Will there be another promised land yet to be revealed? And why, instead of flashy plagues that show of God's strength and majesty, will this exodus lead to the death of God's chosen one? On the mountain, Jesus' glory was revealed through light, sound, and guest appearances. But soon, his glory will be revealed in suffering. On the mountain, his disciples witnessed him transfigured before them. But when his glory is fully revealed at the cross, they won't be there to see it, because they will have fled. And yet it will be there, in the place of deepest suffering, that the fullness of Jesus' glory will be revealed. Even so, that will not be the end of the story. The second exodus will not look like the powerful plagues of the past that bested Pharaoh with God's mighty hands. Instead, the exodus that leads the world out of bondage to sin and death will lead straight through the cross, where God's hands are outstretched in a different way, straight through the cross and to an empty tomb. This is the journey before us at Lent. From this mountaintop, through the valley of the shadow of death, to resurrection morning. May we have eyes to see Christ's glory at every stop along the way. Thanks be to God. Amen.